Thank you. Okay. So, first of all, the outline for teaching, today's teaching, is first talk about some of the highlights of life stories of historical Buddha Shakyamuni. So within the life stories, there is an early life experience of secular life, worldly life. And then second part of life is awakening life or spiritual life. And that can be also explained essential teachings, early teachings and later teachings. And we could also include some of the teachings that are also spreading in the West. So first of all, the importance of knowing essential highlights of historical Buddha's life story is that we will know what are the sources of the teachings so far you have received from here or from other places. Sometimes we simply receive the teaching and focus on the practice. There's a tradition in Tibetan spiritual realm. There's a emphasis on the biographies of teachers, biographies of scholars, biographies of one's masters or meditators, or biographies of one's parents or individual that is inspiring for you. So if we discuss about the highlights of life story, then we'll also know the sources of teachings. For example, what is the sources or background sources of Four Noble Truth? Or what are the sources of analytical approaches in Buddhist teachings? So, and also you'll hear how is this life story relevant to your life or to our life, although historical Buddha occurred in, or more than, now it seems 2,560 years, or actually 2,600 years this year. I think there's some celebrations. But anyhow, so let's start from the beginning. So first of all, so these are some basic, some are maybe a little bit different. So first of all, historical Buddha Shakyamuni was born within his royal family. Nowadays, the royal family pilgrimage sites is within the Indian, modern India. And his birthplace is within modern Nepal. And although there are some debates about the locations of his birthplace. But anyhow, so he was born in this royal family. And from the beginning, there is some great anxiety. Sounds like great anxiety within his parents, kings and queen of that region. Some concern that maybe their son, historical Buddha, may be exposed to spiritual life or religious life or some other type of life that hinders royal life. So their parents were very, very attached, very, very focused on or committed how to raise their son so then their son can continue the royal life, so then maintain their kingdom and continue from king to prince and then next generations like that. So during that time, the traditional sources says that the spiritual or ascetic practitioner or a spiritual or a great spiritual master predicted that either this historical Buddha might become king or might become a great spiritual leader. Any case, both the prediction just means that the historical Buddha had great potential to be a leader, whether it is a secular leader or spiritual leader. So because of that prediction, it makes sense that king and queen and ministers during that time restrained from historical Buddha, not to expose to religious life or spiritual life, because then that may interfere to maintain their royalty. Now, this so far what I share is it happened more than 2,600 years ago, but it is still relevant in our life. I thought especially it was directly relevant when I first came here 20 years ago. 20 years is different now. I think I can see that there is a spiritual growth in the U.S. But 20 years or during 60 or 70 years, until that time, there was a great emphasis in the Western society in general not to expose to discomforts. I think it still does within our life, but especially not to expose to the concept of death and dying. And there is a great effort to restrain and avoid from talking about death and dying. But I noticed that insurance companies are ahead of spiritual teachers or car companies. They talk that if you can die anytime and your finger will cause this and so they have great concepts, the uncertainty of death and they bring this awareness. But then we treat that as a commercial, not as spiritual. But we could adopt that as a spiritual practice. Maybe next time we may be able to adopt. So I see still relevance collectively and individually that we do avoid and restrain from all kinds of discomforts. Partly it has to do with the human nature, and partly it also, there's other human nature, and that is totally exposed, totally understand as best we can. And so I think the both side can be nature. It's not avoiding is only the nature, but I think exposing is also deeper nature. Maybe superficially our nature is to avoid. It seems avoiding and kind of sheltering ourselves from life struggles. And I shared before that it helps. But then we have this tendency to assume that if one time we get some relief through avoidance, therefore then we can avoid situation consistently, almost forever. Then we go through the cycle, which is called samsara. So let me go back to the birth. So when historical Buddha was born, he was given a name called Siddhartha. So Buddha was his more spiritual name. His birth name, let me go a little bit before that. So when he was born, his mother passed away within or less than 7 days. So you could come up all kinds of interpretations, whatever that means. But that is the fact that all the sources indicates that his mother passed away after or within 7 days. And so that means he was raised by his mother's younger sister. So that also raised some interesting whether mother is needed in order to grow, in order to raise. And so historical Buddha passed away. In the West can be viewed as major trauma. So trauma experience individual could actually or achieve enlightenment. And somehow it relates to Tibetan culture when, like, historical or Dalai Lama, let's say, he was recognized as 14th Dalai Lama around age of 5 and raised by his teachers and attendants and tutors. And now you can see that Dalai Lama is actually functioning way different if he were not recognized as 14th Dalai Lama. So anyhow, his name was historical Buddha received a name called Siddhartha. Siddhartha is his birth name. I understand that his naming ceremony was taken the 5th day of his birthday, whatever significance that means. Siddhartha means one who establishes meaning or one who achieves meaning. So if I make it complete, one who achieves meaning of life. So that name was given at the 5th day of his birth. That sounds great meaning from the beginning, regardless of the predictions. And so after the birth, until age 16, so he was raised in his royal life and all the luxurious, all the comfortable, comforting life that were available at that time. So it was very, very interesting for me raising this historical Buddha or Siddhartha as a life that is not exposed to any suffering. So it's a great metaphor, remaining in this kingdom. This kingdom can be like our own personal world or house or building. And so historical Buddha was raised within that small, I guess, cave or small, well-fenced kingdom that is not exposed to any human suffering. So sometimes I think we also do to bring all the life insurance, although I'm doing some business, not business, I'm trying to buy something. but we create lots of comforting life situation that is sometimes not actually realistic. So I think people call some kind of control freak or something. So when the situation is not perfect, there is no way that we can bring all the comfort our life. We bring one, and then since it is the nature of impermanence, then it changes. No matter how much we try to retain or sustain with that. So anyhow, the next to that is then, so Buddha was, or Siddhartha got married age 16, and then continue his, what I call, relationship until age 29. So it seemed the historical Buddha or Siddhartha lasts for how many years? 14 years? 14 years of relationship. And historical Buddha and the prince had one son named Rahula. Rahula is one of the planets named, and in Tibetan it's called Dzogchen. Means sound holder. I'm not sure there's such planet in the Western astrological. But anyhow, so he had son, and now he's about age 26. No, sorry, 29. And by 29, then of course, now reached 28. And there, it seems what it means is that we cannot really suppress, we cannot oppress, or we cannot control. And so somehow at the age of 29, he was able to expose to real life outside of his fence or the boundary. So when he was going, when he was visiting his subjects or the community with his attendants, the first exposure that he had was seeing an old person walking with a stick. So this is a great metaphor, person who was completely avoided and sheltered, not to see any human sufferings. And for the first time, you see an old man walking with a stick. Even 29, it might be maybe psychological, developmentally, I don't know, early age person can expose to old age. But anyhow, this, for me, it can be shocking to see old age sufferings at age 29. That's very, very delayed psychologically, spiritually delayed, health-wise delayed. From any perspective, that's very, very delayed. So then Siddhartha asked his attendant, what is that? And so attendance, this is old age experience. And so, although he's at 29, he was very curious to ask, do we all reach that old age? And of course, his attendant is exposed to both the world, the royal world inside and outside human experiences. And so that was, we could say, that was his first I guess trigger of his spiritual journey, or his first experience or motivator to find what is life. And so next to that, then he saw a person who is sick. And so of course he asked the same question, do we all get sick in our life? And the attendants say, yes, we do get sick too, not only old age. And I wonder how Siddhartha felt at that time. If we saw old age or sick person for the first time in our life, later age, that could be quite shocking. Maybe that might be also very conducive. Even it is a shocking and dramatic, it seems it also becomes a great motivator or great source of spiritual practice or self-care or whatever we need to do. And after that, Siddhartha also exposed to death, I guess corpse or dead body, and asked the same. And so these three are the major source of personal transformation. So this exactly happened with the historical Buddha. So sometimes I do feel that in order to advance our practices, it is helpful to have a field trip, Dharma field trip. Dharma field trip to hospitals, Dharma field trips to senior centers, Dharma field trips to downtown, just expose to the whole, really complete nature and reality of life. So, before I mention the fourth one, so based on this life story, now it provides me the source of the source of the importance of knowing things through analysis instead of through faith. So one of the major historical Buddha's teaching starts with all bhikshus or scholars accept my teaching only through thorough analysis, like the goldsmith who analyzes the authenticity of gold through rubbing or scratching or other means. So this teaching actually relates to his life story, because he, for the last 29 years, he was accepting his life through faith, the faith that was established by his parents. But then through exposing these three main life, what I call three existential sufferings, meaning the minute we exist, we experience these three. Maybe different degrees. So because he started exposed to, then he started analyzing, what is life? Is life only the comforting life in the royal family? Or is life how we feel comfortable within our life at home or at work or in this Dharma center? And so it really, more we expose to the reality, greater reflection, understanding, and analytic approach we get. So this piece, actually, this so far, the exposing to the reality and staying 29 years of faith-based life shows the source where the teachings, Buddhist teaching, the emphasis on analysis and direct experience and reliable sources. These three methods are the ways to know ourselves, to know others, to know the existence of the world. What are your thoughts while I'm sharing this? What thoughts, what reflections are going through with you while I was sharing?
Would you repeat those last three factors that you mentioned?
You mean three ways of knowing?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, three ways of knowing. One is analytical knowledge. First is analytical knowledge, so analyzing whether life is just suffering or just happiness, or life is both, or combination, or lots of variations. Instead of having this one narrow understanding, either life is full of suffering or life is totally comfortable. So if we engage with the analytical knowledge, then we can analyze and gain insight. The second is experiential knowledge. So not only just talking and imagining and fantasizing, one needs to put the analytical understanding into one's direct practice, and that is called experiential knowledge. The third one is reliable sources. Reliable sources meaning teaching or lecture or something that does not contradict each other, that the teachings and meanings have a consistency and it is supported by some valid reasons. Okay. All right. So what else? Yes.
What's going through my head is, even though it was so long ago, I feel like that's very much still present today. Like, we have systems for all our suffering. So people in hospitals are sick. They're out of the way. You don't see them. Homeless, they're in their spot. Don't see them. And so I feel like very sheltered in that way. And
yes.
I feel like it's still present. even mental health, when you show emotion and you show
yeah.
pain, don't look at that
yeah.
person.
Yeah. So this is one of the examples. 3,000 years ago, 4,000 years ago, and now we still cope our suffering or unwanted experience almost similar. And partly that can be nature, or partly, I don't know, maybe we are either taking so much rebirth that we do it again without any progress and go the same. So I see, how about yourself? Do you see that we still continue this kind of shelter, maybe compartmentalize? How do you say that?
Compartmentalize.
Yeah, compartmentalizing. So do you see that still doing in our life? So the important part is simply recognizing when we do. Okay? When we do, it's not a negative. It's not negative. It's not our issue or problem. The issue, it becomes issue when we are not aware of them. And then we'll spend another 1 year, another 5 years, 10 years, and then after 10 years, we look back and we realize, oh, I had an automatic life for 10 years. Where was my life last 10 years, 1 year? So anyhow, okay. So these three exposures are related to human suffering and also related to the samsara part. Samsara or cyclic existence that we go through this cycle. But the fourth one is different. The fourth one, then Siddhartha exposed to this ascetic practitioner or spiritual practitioner and asked the same. What is that person? And so Atintan says, this is a spiritual practitioner, or person who commits one's life, transforming one's life, trying to overcome these three sufferings and other sufferings. So what this means is when we go through these three main, old age, sickness, and death, either happen to us or others. So it seems that these three are greatest spiritual source. Because these three are, the more traumatic it is, the greater realization we will get. Okay. So therefore, even these are very, very traumatic that we don't want. But if we expose to them, that leads to really the fourth great transformation happens. So just looking at these four, there's a whole teaching. The first three explains about the first two noble truths, and the last one explains the third and the fourth noble truth. So we have complete four noble truths right there. Okay. So now, if I continue the life story, so age 29, because of these exposures, Siddhartha then left his royal life. Now this is a major transition. In Buddhist classical teaching, that can be called renunciation. There are external renunciations and internal renunciations. External renunciation will be, there's a great story, there's a teacher and student, and teacher gave some teaching like nature of samsara and different types of suffering, and this student really understood and had some emotional understanding and mentioned that I'm going to now practice. I'm going to renounce my current life. And so this student spent some retreat center in the mountains. Of course, I'm talking in Tibet, so mountains everywhere, like a forest, like Olympic forest. So then this student stayed there for a short time, and the emotional wisdom actually dissipates, almost taking substance. And then students said, well, I'm missing my family members, missing my family, my possession. So this student actually returned. But there's other stories, students who completely, not only emotional knowledge, but also really understood their path very, very clear, and then stay in a retreat for a longer time and continue for the path. But here, renunciation, internal renunciations, that is, I think in the West, these teachings are still relevant. So there's external renunciations of, for example, this is spring and reaching to summer, so many of you might have a garage sales. That's a very good first step of renouncing material life, at least reduce. That is helpful. But not only that, one can reduce many external whatever factors, materials, as source of happiness. So the actual renunciation is the internal renunciation. Now, internal renunciation can be applicable within our life. We don't have to become a monk or nun or between or none of them. Renunciation meaning transforming, understanding first, and then transforming our internal thoughts, destructive thoughts, or unhelpful thoughts, unhelpful emotions. Those we can transform, we can understand. And so the focus is really the renouncing of these internal struggles. That doesn't mean that we totally eliminate, because total elimination is, first of all, impossible goal. Secondly, that is extreme, because out of historical Buddha's spiritual journey came up middle way. Middle way meaning very, very realistic, and I will explain it later. So what I was talking?
Renunciation.
Renunciation, internal renunciation. Is that, how is this internal renunciation relevant to you?
That you don't become addicted to your own emotional patterns. You sort of renounce the method that you're used to finding comfort in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that is applicable, like reducing stress. Reducing stress means dukkha. That's my new translation. Okay. Dukkha in the past, unsatisfactory or something like that can be true, but really stress, distress is what dukkha means. Because dukkha means when we have experience of happiness, we still feel something like stress. If we gain something, we feel stress. If we lose something, of course we feel stress. So the stress is everywhere, whether we feel good or bad. So dukkha is same. Dukkha exists when we feel good or bad, or happy or unhappy. Any question came up? Yes.
In my mind, there's this term that keeps sitting here, and it's unburdened awareness.
Mm-hmm.
Unburdened.
Unburdened. That
awareness.
Means. That means.
I think, and when you said without stress, it would be an awareness without stress.
Yeah. Yeah, that would be like maybe taking some painkiller for the moment that we don't feel pain. Now that the question is how much that is effective, both the short term and the long term. And especially if something is stressful short term, but if the long term, if it is beneficial, then of course we endure the short term difficulties in order to achieve this long term benefit for ourselves and others. It is certainly worthwhile. So, renunciation also means sense of urgency leads to great happiness and joy. You cannot believe whether sense of urgency can lead very, very positive experience. If we were told that we are going to live 1 year, who knows? Maybe that's why I'm exploring this life insurance. Not out of the fear of life insurance, but knowing the death and the impermanence. What did I say?
Sense of urgency.
So sense of urgency. If we were told that we are going to live 1 year, the reality is the great practitioners, spiritual practitioners, would focus only today. I guess maybe we are in a different society. But still, if we know what is important for us, what is our value, what is our meaning, that kind of reflection would be elicited by the sense of urgency in our life. Unless we reach to a point where we feel great confidence after engaging with practices, living the life how we want to live. And there's a great confidence, fearlessness, whenever the death comes, we are ready. Now that is a great achievement. Now that is a great nirvana. That is enlightenment. That is a state of cessation of dukkha and sources of dukkha. If you read the 7-point Lojong teachings, at the very end, there's one verse, and I really wish that that would be my life experience. And at the end it says, now I do not have any remorse if death comes now. Now that is a great. That shows the person actually experienced the sense of urgency long time ago or recently, and person has really engaged one's own value and meaning. And there is no regret. And there is also one of the qualities of enlightenment. There are many qualities of enlightenment. One of the enlightenment qualities is called fearlessness. Fearlessness. You have seen Indian currency note, bill, paper note, which has a 4-line face. There's a pillar, and it's Ashoka, King Ashoka's emblem. So there's a pillar with the 4-line faces. And those are 4 fearless qualities. Line in the wild can be fearless of other animals.
So you said there's 4 qualities?
Yeah, 4 qualities. It will come next time. If you want to know the list, I can say briefly. I can say briefly. Fearlessness. Saying that the unawareness is the source of all our suffering, and I am confident with that statement, and there is no contradiction, no criticism if someone really analyzes. And then the other call, so basically fearlessness, this path, whatever the path of compassion, path of mindfulness, is effective antidote to overcome our negative emotions, to express, to make that statement, one has great confidence and fearlessness, that the confidence about the truth, the fearlessness about telling truth, what is the sources of suffering, and what is suffering, and what is the sources of peaceful mind, and what are the sources of methods. So saying those great confidence, meaning telling truth without any fear. So that's really the fearlessness, 4 fearlessness. Okay? All right. Okay. So let's go back life story a little bit. So we reach age 26. So after the 29, yes. 29. So sometimes we need to ask our question a little bit. Wherever age we are, where am I in this journey? So the biography that I'm sharing and that you're learning is not just irrelevant. This is a great practice. So if you are 29, this is where I am. But anyhow, I don't mean to emulate exactly, but in terms of the transformative stages. Okay. So 29, leave the palace, luxurious life, and really seek for the truth. And that is, I believe, that you all are doing. Buddhist teaching practice really means seeking for the truth, whatever that truth is. That is, because of that, as I mentioned earlier, three ways of knowing are practice in balance. What do you call it? Tandem? They go together? What about three? Then you say treat them? I don't know. So in our life, sometimes we focus only on the analysis. Other times we focus on the experience. And the practices that we need both. Okay. So anyhow, so age 29 escaped or left or departed from the early life into now life into spiritual or transformative life. So because Siddhartha exposed to this ascetic practitioner, so it makes sense that one may actually explore and emulate that path. So for the next 6 years, historical Buddha spent time with this ascetic life, meaning living with very, very harsh life that we cannot actually live with that life, especially in the West. I just had this thought that we have. I just came in, I just want to share. This is my style. So even there's a comfort in the restrooms and the restroom seats. They're very, very comfort. It's very amazing in the West. Whereas in other culture, a room will be warm, but restroom, there's no warm. There's no need. Maybe more fresh air is needed. It's just a, it's really different. So anyhow, this ascetic practice for 6 years, and you have seen some of the images. But after this 6 years ascetic life, there is a realization that this type of practice is not a right path or effective solution, effective antidote, or effective methods to overcome human suffering, and especially those three, old age, sickness, and death. Because he was triggered to find a solution to overcome human suffering, not to connect with divine being. This is very important in Buddhism. We're not connecting with the divine being. And I will share you a little bit my thoughts when I talk about Four Noble Truths briefly. So this life story is a source of the teaching in Buddhism called union of wisdom and compassion. Union of wisdom and skillful means. Because when we establish or cultivate union of wisdom and compassion, then we have a balance. Balance meaning complete. But if we have only the insight and wisdom, only the compassion, then it's extreme. So all of these balance teaching and practice moderations, that is moderation methods. They all actually came out of historical Buddha's experience of extreme practice for the last 6 years. And that actually triggered that led to have more balance. And even when he was, there was a musician actually. There was this musician who was, and this is one of the examples how enlightened being or transformed realized person can be very skillful. And having wisdom is skillful together. So there's a musician who was very, very attached to one's music. But this individual want to engage with Buddhist teaching and practice, or dharma, learning truth. So this musician asks historical Buddha, I want to practice dharma, but I cannot give away my music. My music is my life. How can I give away my life? Maybe this is related to each of you, whatever is important. So you want to practice dharma, but then you don't want to give up whatever life or situation you have. And so then historical Buddha realized that this individual musician needs very, very skillful teachings. Not like, now practice this, Four Noble Truths or that. That would not be skillful. That would not be insightful. Because transformative person have a knowledge, understanding what is the need, what is the disposition, what is the level and stage of that person. So anyhow, to make it long story short, so historical Buddha taught these middle way through his own music. So teaching how when you tight your string extremely tight, then you don't get the sound that you want. But if you, do you say slack? Slacken? I don't know.
Yeah.
Loose?
Loosen.
Then you don't get the sound that you want. But you really need the string, the tightness, just the right dosage or right tuning or touch. What do you call touch?
Tension.
Tension. Yes, tension. Yes. I was saying touch. So that was very, very appropriate teaching. And so this musician, oh, okay, I'm doing this all the time, and now I need to apply my music with my life. So I hope you could also find like this. So going back to the middle way approach. So after that 6 years, went through some healing, like rebalancing, recovering physical health, and then Siddhartha went to Bodh Gaya, the historical Buddha, the historical Bodh Gaya now in Bodh Gaya. So went there, And at that time, he was, I think, 35 years old. 35 years old, and there's some sources that says 49 days of deep meditation practice. Meditation doesn't mean stay silent. Meditation also requires, there's an analytical meditation like a Vipassana, and there is a Shamatha meditation and other meditations for the last 49 days. Practice these, all the path, now what you're hearing, condense into this 49 days and then reach to what is called enlightenment. Now, definition of enlightenment, or Buddha. The term Buddha, first of all, Buddha means awakened one. So Siddhartha was his birth name, but then later on, after the achievement of enlightenment, the sources say that people ask, who are you? And then his response was, I'm Buddha. I don't think he would say that, but I want to keep the traditional sources, and then I want to share my thoughts on that without getting rid of the traditional sources, whatever it says, just leave it, but share. So anyhow, so Buddha is more like a spiritual name or transformative name. When person transforms, get a new name. That is a new identity, who we are. So enlightenment or Buddha means two qualities, then I will move on. So the first one is realization. Realization from this mild to the most maximum. So usually people think, oh, enlightenment or nirvana realization has to do with the very end. That's really not true. Each moment of free from stress, that's one nirvana. Okay? Then you have one free of anger. That's one nirvana. Okay? One free of attachment, or one letting go state of letting go. That is one nirvana. That is transformation. So realization, transformation go together, and that is what Buddha means. So here's my essential point. Buddha is not authoritarian title. It's not an external title. If it were a title, then it is our internal title. So whoever, all of you or outside of this building, whoever meets those two criteria of definition qualifies as Buddha. Okay? That's how I like when I study this logic, epistemology. We just focus on the definition. If someone fits in this definition, then we accept. But if someone doesn't fit this definition, then we don't accept. So definition is very, very defining factor in that sense. So that means whenever you experience transformation, state of transformation for a few seconds to 1 minute at that time, then we are Buddha. Of course, then if we have an enduring one, then we have a more Buddha qualities. So Buddha is what I usually understood is very, very individualistic, not like authoritarian qualities. So each person can become Buddha. And so because of that, I feel a great joy with this concept. And that is what I also call infallible karma, or cause and effect. Because if I feel state of this stability within myself, no one can take it away. And I cannot take away your dukkhas. I cannot transfer my experience realization to you, nor your transformation realization towards me. So that just means it is very, very individualistic qualities. So that provides lots of freedom. That's what I meant. Lots of freedom and choices within oneself. Okay. So now let me move on a little bit. So after the enlightenment, in terms of celebration, there's a one celebration called Visakh. Visakh month that is celebrated encompasses birth date and then enlightenment and nirvana, all three together, in Southeast Asian traditions called Visakh. But in India and Nepal, it's also called Buddha Purnima, sometimes called Buddha Jayanti, and it's a national holiday in India, Nepal, and also many Southeast countries, as well as Christmas and some Muslim national holidays in India. But I didn't hear so far Obama listing Buddhism as world tradition, not yet. It is the same observation that I made in Barnes & Noble and Big Book Stories. In the past, they have Eastern thought section, and that's where you find the Buddhist textbooks. But now they have changed a little bit. So I don't know, the change is happening a little bit. But it is, I think it's objective to say Buddhism as Eastern thought instead of putting in religion, because I would think that 80% Buddhist teaching is more philosophy, psychology, and not religion, comparing to other religions. But anyhow. Okay, so now, after 49 days, then Buddha had another important date, and that is the first teaching. So between that 49 days, there was a request of giving teachings. But then historical Buddha kept silence for 49 days. 49 days, kind of processing. So when individuals die, we also observe for 49 days. And I have been trying to find some sources about 49 days, and I couldn't find other 49 days, but besides between the time the enlightenment and the first teaching of Four Noble Truths, 49 days exact. So anyhow, there was lots of process. And there's some kind of decision-making whether the teaching that I have is understandable or is it the appropriate, effective teaching, useful, beneficial for others or not. But anyhow, after 49 days, then the Four Noble Truths was given. Now, briefly, in terms of... Now, Four Noble Truths is the very, very first teaching that was ever recorded, given by historical Buddha. Now, Four Noble Truths itself is, again, not connecting with the divine sources. That's a unique of Buddhism. Doesn't mean better or worse, just a different approach. But Four Noble Truths simply talks about the truth of suffering, sources of suffering, and the cessation of suffering and the path to achieve the cessation of dukkha. Now, this is the first teaching. The emphasis is really how to overcome one's dukkha and sources of dukkha, and how to achieve relief from dukkha, and what are the paths. That is first Buddhist teaching, and that is still the main teaching. Now, just reflecting on Four Noble Truths, you can clearly see that the Four Noble Truths is also systematic, transformative path based on historical Buddha's exposure to those three main suffering: the suffering of old age, suffering of sickness, and death. So this teaching shows, for me, my interpretation is exposing to these dukkha in general, and especially these three, must have really penetrated through his consciousness very, very deep. So after the enlightenment, the very first teaching is Four Noble Truths. Starts from recognizing suffering. Now, I want to mention briefly, and I mentioned earlier, I used the term comfort and discomfort, but it is really, really important to able to recognize and process our daily life sufferings and stress. That is really crucial source of transformation and spiritual practice. But that doesn't mean that we are searching and looking for. It comes, I'm sure, through your direct experience. It comes, but when it comes, now we have a different attitude. Or curiosity. I think Buddha's analytical approach is really based on curiosity. Curiosity and openness. Curiosity and openness will allow us to examine, analyze, explore. So now you can see the relevance of Four Noble Truths with historical Buddha's life experience. So in that sense, actually, it is now related in the West or in Europe that Buddhist teaching is actually understood as form of psychology. Psychology focuses on how to overcome mental health issues and what are the treatment, what are the methods, methodology to overcome that. So that is really the source of Four Noble Truths, based on the life experience. Okay, any question before I move with several thoughts? Yes.
So, when he gave this, his first teaching of those Four Noble Truths, how many people were there? Were there thousands, like when the Dalai Lama gives the Kala Chakra? Or?
No, five. Five of those ascetic practitioners who happened to be in Varanasi, Sarnath. And of course, I guess in the West you call it loser. So these five ascetics call historical Buddha as a loser, living the ascetic life and failure, and so criticize and put down and all kinds of bullying, I guess. But anyhow, then historical Buddha actually encountered these five ascetic colleagues, I guess, practitioners. And then Buddha gave Four Noble Truths to these five. And the place where he gave, this is what I want to share a little bit, Four Noble Truths was given at a deer park in Sarnath, and the location and the deer itself really is a main symbol, animal symbol in Buddhist teachings. You'll find a deer sitting on top of the temple instead of having fence over here. So deer, the essential teaching, ethical teaching of Buddhism is non-harming. Non-harming or non-violence, the path of non-harming. So non-harming means if we cannot benefit others, not to harm. And that is really the main ethics practice, as best we can. And deer symbolizes non-harming, non-violence, comparing to many animals. And you can actually experiment in your yard. They may eat veggie, and I guess I also grow veggie a little bit, and I suddenly understood that I'm not growing veggie to have. If I have it, great. If not, there's some culture in this town. You grow veggie and deer comes and eat, and then you get chance to talk about it. That I grow veggie and this happened and that happened, and it's kind of a social means to fit in. I don't expect any veggies at the end, and I know my deer, or not my deer, but these five deers that come and come and may eat. But of course, I'm also a little bit assertive to put little fence, but I know that eventually they decide. So, but for my own mental purpose, put kind of pseudo fence and easily reachable. But anyhow, you look deer, and deer is totally vegetarian, what I understand. And looking at deer, the peacefulness and non-harming and great vegetarian being. And so that is not only just giving teaching anywhere, but giving teaching at a deer park, which also resonates and symbolizes the main core of the teaching. So that's how it was given, first five, and then at the deer park. So that's how it started. Any question? Yes.
Yeah, I have one question. So about this. So when the Buddha was looking for an answer to the question of how to end suffering,
Yes.
And then when he found it, that's kind of what we call enlightenment, and then he went to share it with his
right.
five former colleagues. So his form, the ascetics, they were practicing really what we might call really advanced forms of meditation, very
mm-hmm.
high degrees of concentration,
right.
you know, trance states, all these things. So right. what were they trying to achieve?
Well, what they're achieving is simple, like shamatha, the highest level of shamatha, that rests one's mind in certain object for many, many hours,
mm-hmm.
and basically staying in one room, one place. And so... So that is why it is called extreme practice. Now you actually the shamatha is because of that it's a common, but the method is slightly different between Hindu and other tradition and Buddhism. Now you see vipassana practice. Vipassana practice do not stay in one place and this peaceful mind. Rather exposed to all types of life experience and learn about the suffering and nature of the suffering and the function of suffering and also how to actually overcome through exposing, not through avoiding, like staying in one retreat center or in a cave and not exposing to the society. But so that's how now you see that these Buddhist teachings are applicable for lay people, non-monastic life. After all, it has to do how we appear to others, whether monk or nun or spiritual person or not. It also depends. It depends highly our mental state. Our internal transformations. Okay. Any question? Any thoughts? Anything? Did I respond to you? I felt maybe I did not connect completely.
Well, no, I think my question was about the ascetics, and so
yeah.
I mean, I think your answer was that they were, in a sense, just
right.
pursuing these states of mind.
Right. So basically. Basically, in Buddhism, there's a two classical meditation. One is called shamatha, calm abiding, or I call it mental stability. Just having a mental stability or peaceful mind, that is helpful. But that is not really going to take care of many life stress, especially when we go to work. Watch TV, go to downtown and reach certain age or transition like that. The shamatha itself would not really help. The vipassana or compassion, empathy would really expand. So that's why we need both shamatha and vipassana. And also, it is not a realistic to have a peaceful mind all day or all night. That's really not... That is similar to Buddha's early life, staying in royal life without exposing to any disturbances or discomforts. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Was there any particular event that made it imperative that Buddha leave the ascetic life? And
yeah.
You know, because he probably was under a teacher, and he had, like you say,
yes.
there was lots of pressure on him to be the star in that field,
yeah.
and he walked away from it.
Yeah.
Was there anything that triggered that, or was it just he came?
Well, he realized that. That his physical body is not able to maintain at that point. So it's a physically, biologically, but there's some ideal concept that one can survive without grosser food, with meditative food, or simple water can survive many, many years. There's some concept like that. I heard that's what Ramda was trying. I heard from some, I'm really not sure. I heard from someone who went there. There's some concept that if you just drink water and you can survive for many years. There's a such concept, but it requires lots of training and need a reliable teacher in order to do that. So just realizing that is not a right path to achieve enlightenment. Maybe enlightenment is not like peaceful mind. Enlightenment means one is capable to transform whatever situation encounters in a life.
It just seems interesting that there must have been generations of ascetics who passed these techniques down, and none of them came across this the idea that perhaps we should change direction.
So are you asking? There might be ascetic practitioners still. And
I mean, but who?
If you go to YouTube, YouTube has all kinds of some, but not all. So there might be.
That there aren't. It just seems interesting that that such highly developed spiritual practitioners didn't, and there were generations of these people who never came across Buddha's discovery.
Yeah, so isn't it that they were trying to respond to a different question?
Maybe that's it.
I mean, the Buddha was trying to answer the question of suffering.
Overcoming suffering.
Not
only temporary.
A different question.
Right. So the shamatha meditation or single-pointed mind would help to overcome grosser level of suffering and sources of suffering. But in order to really transform from the basis, the source of suffering, then one really needs vipassana type of, not only vipassana, but vipassana type of methods. So that is how historical Buddha understood and introduced both the shamatha and the vipassana in classical teachings. Okay, any concerns came up? Because that's my practice, is to benefit you as best I can and not to harm you. So anything that I say harmful things to you? Now sometimes when I and you talk about reality, it may hurt other people. But then out of this intention to overcome suffering and suffering, source of suffering, I may say it anyway. Maybe it is harmful now, but hopefully this may lead to reflect on what is life, what is natural life, what is really important for me and for others. And if I have 1 month, 1 year, 3 years, 5 years to live, what I want to do, maybe I want to do all. That's what I like. And that is also basis of what life I have now. And this goes back to historical Buddha's life. And historical Buddha's life. And this is the basis of how Vajrayana, Tantrayana came out of it. Came out of Buddhism. So there was a great king. This king is similar to that musician. I guess maybe we may connect with these individuals. So this great king, I guess, faced dilemma. What to do with this king's kingdom, royal life? And this king also understood the importance of Dharma teachings and practice, but could not give up lay people's life with the family members. And so this very king asked to, again, this has to do the wisdom, the union of wisdom and the skillfulness. And so historical Buddha responded to this very king. First of all, king says, I want to do Dharma, but I don't want to give up my family life. So please give me a teaching that I can maintain my family life as well as I can do the Dharma. Then the whole Vajrayana teaching is introduced. So Vajrayana teaching, that's why many of the Thangas, you see more lay customs, lay appearance, and that's the story behind this. So Dharma can be done, any form of life, whether you are individual, family members, or in the community, or wherever you are, wherever, whenever we have the mind and the consciousness, then we are able to practice. Any questions? Anything you need to know now?
Are these lay people able to achieve enlightenment themselves?
Yes. Yeah, enlightenment here in the West, whenever you are able to reduce your stress, I'm not saying to please you. I am very confident that is nirvana. That state of mind is state of nirvana. I'm not saying that you are totally enlightened or totally nirvanic, I'm not sure what term I can use. But at the moment, yes, we are. We are, really. Okay. Now, at the end of Buddha's life story, at the age 80, then he passed away. And the place now is called Kushalnagar. It's northern India, close to Nepal, and he passed away eventually. There's a different sources, but the usual sources that he accepted food that was given to him. So there's a practice that whatever is offered for the monks or monastic life, they usually accept it. And so there is some source says this food might have affected. But anyhow, historical Buddha passed away at the age of 80, and his last teachings are one teaching that says all conditions are impermanence. All conditions are impermanence or impermanent?
Impermanent.
Impermanent. And then, at the end, these are the last moment. And then at the end, he also mentioned that the liberation or nirvana or enlightenment is within you. It's within your reach, within yourself. And now, it depends on you whether you want to achieve state of overcoming suffering or source of suffering. That also means you yourself is the protector or the master. And so everything is then focus on each individual's. That's a great teaching, and I'm going to end with that, saying that these individualistic transformations are the effective ways to overcome greater national, international, universal problems, because after all, each of us find a peaceful mind, open mind, more curious mind, stable mind, then it seems the rest of the world around us is also calm and peaceful. So if each of us live our life moment by moment like that, that is a great, that's a great revolution. So with that, I will end. I think we reach exact time, 8:45, and we'll do dedication prayer. And also remember that this is the Sagadawa or Enlightenment Month. So this is a very, very important day that we all met here. And I hope that this life story and the teachings and this month of enlightenment would actually bring some benefits to yourself and all others. Jambai Bawe Chidai Kemba Tangkun Loi Sambo Teyang Teshen De Teta Kunje Jesu Talo
Thank you. Thank you all of you.